Welcome to Women's Rights, a podcast about women's ordination, written and produced by students at Smith College.
I'm Olivia Kavanaugh.
And I'm Talia Shakun Berkelhammer.
We're your hosts for this episode of Women's Rights. This season, we are exploring the story of women's ordination in American Soto Zen Buddhism, Reformed Judaism, and the Episcopal Church. To do so, we've interviewed women in each of these traditions, some of whom were in the first generation of ordained women within their religious communities.
In this episode, we're going to dive into the life paths of three ordained Soto Zen Buddhist priests. We'll inquire about their childhood religious role models, their struggles and perceived benefits from being a woman, and encounters with patriarchy. We'll learn about their Dharma teachers' perspectives on religious texts and how they envision the Soto Zen tradition moving forward.
We want to start off our podcast today by giving our listeners a little background on Soto Zen Buddhism. Buddhism is a religion with hundreds of millions of followers around the world. Inside of Buddhism, there are many traditions with different practices, but they all follow the teachings of the historical Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago. Soto Zen is a school within the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism.
A distinction of Soto Zen is that it's one of the traditions that has never ceased ordaining nuns, female monastics. In Pali, the term for an ordained nun is bhikkhuini. Alternatively, in other Buddhist schools, there has been significant controversy around ordaining nuns. Zen priests traditionally can be married, breaking with certain celibacy and gender norms practiced among other Buddhist communities. Zen arrived in America in the 1960s, when second wave feminism was becoming a major social movement. And this has consequently influenced the infusion of Zen with the American ethos. The first priest we interviewed was Reverend Myozen Joan Amaral, founding and guiding teacher of Zen Center North Shore in Beverly, Massachusetts. She trained at San Francisco Zen Center and is the Dharma heir of Zenkei Blanche Hartman in the lineage of Suzuki Roshi. Upon beginning our interview, Reverend Amaral shared with us.
I knew that this session with you was going to be healing. I really feel that the process of religious inquiry is a process of healing. And so that's why I treasure this chance to have this conversation with you.
Then we interviewed Reverend Toku Scott, an executive director of the Clouds and Water Zen Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. She received Dharma transmission from her teacher, Sojun Diane Martin, in 2020, and before that worked as a newspaper and magazine editor.
Lastly, we interviewed Reverend Nihon Myoshin Trisha Teeter, director and guiding teacher of Udambara Zen Sangha in Evanston, Illinois. She received Dharma transmission from Roshi Diane Martin in 2012. For nearly the last 20 years, she has provided meditation services and Dharma teachings in maximum security prisons and for those on death row.
For each interview, we began by asking them if they had any female religious leaders that they looked up to when they were growing up. We inquired into whether the presence of them or lack thereof helped strengthen their relationship with their respective traditions. Interestingly enough, all three of the priests we interviewed grew up Catholic, the largest Christian denomination that still refuses to ordain women. Reverend Amaral first described her childhood.
When I grew up, I was growing up Catholic. There were zero women in my experience, my immediate experience, who inspired me. In fact, the opposite was true.
Reverend Teeter has a similar response.
I grew up in a Catholic household, and I really couldn't think of a particular woman. But what I could think of were more spiritual encounters.
Finally, Reverend Scott also grew up surrounded by Catholics, but unlike the other two, she found role models in her religion.
Well, Catholic nuns. Yeah. I went to Catholic high school, and the nuns came to I grew up in Montana, and they came to our little farming community every summer for 2 weeks. And I always looked up to them. The other person this is interesting that you gave me the opportunity to reflect on this. The other person who I looked up to was a cousin of my mother's, who was some executive in the Disciples of Christ.
Although role models were present for Reverend Scott, she experienced certain disconnects within the Catholic Church.
The next question we asked looked further into the challenges these priests experienced, not only in childhood, but also in their path to ordination.
Aspects of Reverend Scott's personal identity were dissonant with certain ideals of the Catholic Church.
I applied to enter a women's religious order. I mean, that was what was open to females. That didn't go so well because I was an out lesbian at the time.
We then asked her about being a lesbian in Zen Buddhist communities.
In our tradition, in the Soto Zen lineage, especially here in, you know, liberal Minneapolis, it's a non-issue. I mean, it is just a non-issue. Now, having said that, I can tell you that one of my early teachers, a male, did have an issue with it, but he knew enough to try to work through that himself. But I sensed it, and I ended up leaving to go to another teacher. I wouldn't say that was, well, would I? Yes, I would say that it wasn't primarily that. It was primarily that I felt like there were some sexist dynamics.
External sexism was not the only challenge for Reverend Scott.
My own internalized sexism. And even more important than that, I think, were the struggles that I had in my life as a woman with accepting my body. And the specific example that I can give of that is that, you know, I was ordained at age 57, something like that. And I started studying Buddhism when I was, I don't know, 22, when I was in college. But I could not meditate because I just was not comfortable enough in my body to meditate. And so it was purely an intellectual exercise for me. Very interesting from a religious studies point of view for me. And so I've had to really learn about embodying my practice and learn to value that and work through some of my aversion to embodiment.
Do you feel like you have a more comfortable relationship with your body now?
Oh God, it's night and day.
Reverend Teeter relayed her experience with external sexism.
Well, I grew up in a house with four sisters and a mother. So we grew up very much that girls could do anything. It never dawned on me that we couldn't. In high school, somebody saying something to me that was as if a girl, it was a firefighter who told me that a girl couldn't be, that a woman couldn't be a firefighter. And that was the first time that I really felt a pushback as it related to someone questioning that girls, women couldn't do whatever they wanted. And I just proceeded that way. I just didn't see or allow the fact of my gender to get in the way. I just proceeded. And with ordination, I had women teachers almost always. So from the very beginning of becoming a Buddhist, I would say there was some more conflict in working with in maximum security prisons than on death row, which I have done for many, many years. And those conflicts were more with staff than they were with the incarcerated men. I've had staff, certainly, I was working on death row and had them questioning my relationships with someone and gossiping about relationships.
In our next question, we asked about the ways in which the historically male ordained leadership within Soto Zen Buddhism influenced the current form and style of leadership. Reverend Amaral begins by explaining the reasons that she left the San Francisco Zen Center.
I think I felt the culture of patriarchy and whiteness, control, fear, guilt, kind of ironically, kind of disembodiedness from emotion, you know, from a kind of reality right here. It's like, this is one of the pitfalls in Zen, is getting so stuck in the form that the heart is just...
Reverend Scott similarly felt the influences of male leadership.
Well, I hate to engage in crass gender stereotypes, but what I've seen is that there's a... I think the more male-oriented style is given to more of an intellectual approach. And I would just then reinforce my comments also about the lack of focus on embodiment, embodied practice.
Both reverends see the problems with disembodiment in Zen Buddhism, which seems to be an effect of historically masculine leadership. Additionally, Reverend Teeter stated the importance of looking at the sexism in the generation before when talking about her own teacher.
And she would have very different stories for you by saying what was her involvement and what was Soto Zen and her male teachers, although she did receive Dharma transmission from a woman. You know, she would have a different story to tell.
We then ask the priests about the ways in which their presence as a woman impacts their embodiment and growth in leadership. We explored the ways womanhood has been a source of strength in their position. Reverend Scott began by describing why this was not a simple question to respond to.
I don't know what womanhood is anymore, frankly. Because I don't know how to separate who I am and what my sensibility is from having grown up female and remaining female throughout my life.
Reverend Scott is importantly addressing that there is no singular and identifiable fixed state of womanhood. Everyone has their own definition or abstract sense of what it means to them. Now, let's hear what Reverend Amaral described about what femininity means to her.
I'm very emotional. I really appreciate the wisdom of the body. I was trained as a dancer. I value sex. You know, all these places that energy gets locked up that I see as patriarchal. And by the way, when I say patriarchal, it's not that I hate men. And I think women absolutely are just as capable of being imprisoned by patriarchy. There is a masculine part of me that feels met by the rigor of Zen training.
Reverend Teeter expanded on Reverend Amaral's idea of womanhood and also included how it influences her own teachings.
I hope that just because of who I am, I bring pretty feminine qualities to whatever it is I'm doing. I'm a good listener. People have a tendency of being able to share with me, hearts share with me. I have a tendency of being very open with the Sangha as it relates to, gender issues as they arise, particularly in the teachings. I seem to always name bodhisattvas. I give them, they all turn into females. And that's just totally by accident. No matter what it is, I've turned that bodhisattva into a female. So whenever we hit moments that are gender, we usually rise to the occasion. If I'm reading something and it's he, I just change it to she.
Reverend Scott's teaching is also influenced by her being a woman.
I really want my students, male and female, to experience awakening, not just as a mental activity, but a very deeply physical one, very deeply embodied experience. And I'm very committed to doing that because it opens up the Dharma in an incredible way.
To wrap up this question, we want to share Reverend Amaral's distinction between a priestess and a priest.
Like, I aspire to be a priestess. It's so much easier to be a priest. A priestess is completely embodied, trusts the body. Like, I still get stuck in my head. I still, like, a priestess for me is shamanic, is like a shaman. You know, this womanly thing maybe that we're talking about is this receptivity, this strength, and this confidence that comes from being so open. There's no defended. There's nothing to defend. I'm open and I'm solid, still tender, you know, still sensitive, but not able to be messed with. That for me is kind of the realm of priestess, and also having a capacity, maybe just with that alone, to heal.
We then dove into the priest's training background and relationships to teachers. Reverend Scott first reflected on the general gender makeup of those in power in Zen today.
I think there are more women priests than men in this, in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And in fact, I think that's true in Soto Zen across the nation, that the majority of priests are women.
Reverend Amaral's experiences highlight the prominence of women in Soto Zen Buddhism in America. So let's hear about her teachers and training at the San Francisco Zen Center.
When I entered San Francisco Zen Center, there was a woman abbot. Blanche Hartman is one of my teachers, and she was the abbess at the time. A few years later, Linda Ruth Cutts became the second abbess. And so we had two women abbesses at San Francisco Zen Center, which was wonderful. When I first got to San Francisco Zen Center, all the people in power were women. So I did not from the beginning connect Buddhism with patriarchy until much later. But you know, patriarchy runs kind of deep and subtly. And Blanche herself said that the biggest issue she had to resolve when she became abbess, the biggest issue was for her was how to resolve the disappointment she felt at being born a girl. And I found with Blanche, she was my I received the Dharma from her. She's my one of my two teachers, who are both women. But that, I always felt that from her. I always felt her struggle, that she was always, I mean, I compete with men, but I think I'm more of the Artemis, you know, the archetypes. I'm more like Artemis. Like, I want to compete as a woman. Blanche, I feel, wanted to compete more like Athena. Is it Athena, the Margaret Thatcher archetype, who wants to be more like a man? I'm not interested in being like a man. So I didn't think that Buddhism was patriarchal, but then I saw that many of the women in power at that time in the late 80s in San Francisco Zen Center were still trying to be like men. That in order to be taken seriously as priests, they needed to look and sound and act like and think like men.
Reverend Amaral shared with us photos of her teachers, Blanche Hartman and Darlene Cohen. While we wish we could show you them, the podcast medium does not allow for that. Fortunately, Reverend Amaral paints us a vivid picture.
Both Darlene and Blanche, they're both my teachers. Can I show you their pictures? All right, here's Blanche. I was just talking about her. She's so powerful and she's so kind of resolute and she's happy. She loved Zen. Okay, and here's Darlene. Darlene is my root teacher, my heart teacher. Very powerful, born on Halloween, wicked sense of humor. She made people really nervous. She was always talking about sex. She was the first one to use the word tampon in the Buddha hall during a Dharma talk. She would talk about her underwear just because she had rheumatoid arthritis and she valued the feel of things. It was a comfort to her. So she was always talking about lace panties and things like that.
The generation of priests we spoke with did not withstand as much sexism as the previous generation of women in Soto Zen. Reverend Scott reflected on her teacher, Diane Martin.
I was drawn to a Clouds in Water Zen Center in St. Paul. The guiding teacher there is a woman. There are several women priests on the teaching staff. And then I ended up being a student of Diane Martin, who's based in Illinois. So my transmission teacher is a woman.
Did that make you feel more connected to your religion, having a female teacher?
Oh yeah, because she, you know, she was ordained 50 years ago, and she went through the deep sexism of that era within the tradition, mm-hmm. you know, and so. And she's a, you know, she has a background as a Jungian analyst. And so she had a very holistic approach to training that I really benefited from.
Next, we focused on their opinions of gender references in Buddhist texts. We began by asking about their understanding of the differences within the Vinaya for nuns and monks. The Vinaya is essentially a rule book for monastic life. And there are an additional 8 rules only for nuns. All 3 priests emphasized one thing about the gender disparity of Vinaya rules. Reverend Scott put it very simply.
It's completely irrelevant. I would just say that I think it's just ghastly.
Reverend Amaral followed up with a few possible explanations for why there has historically been gender inequality in Buddhism, specifically regarding these 8 additional rules in the Vinaya.
Whether we pin misogyny on the Buddha, he can take it being called that. Or, you know, here are the 3 different possibilities that either the Buddha was a misogynist, because guess what? He was a human being. Or 2, he was actually using upaya, skillful means, because he knew that in the highly stratified society, both class and gender of his time, that if he just let women in without any kind of balking, if he just opened wide the door, that it might cause big problems for his sangha. Maybe he was politically astute, but that's the second possibility. And then the third possibility, which is what I'm most interested in, is that never really went down the way we've been told it went down, that it was just the misogyny of future generations, the men or, you know, others with that patriarchal point of view who took hold of a certain narrative, took control and framed the narrative in that way.
We then asked them if they wanted to bring up any other texts to discuss gender in Buddhism. Reverend Scott began by talking about a koan she had carefully studied.
There is a koan that I love very much, and it involves the patriarch Prajnatara. Now, there is a lot of, and Prajnatara is referred to as a man in this koan, but there's a lot of research suggesting Prajnatara was a woman. And I changed it to a woman.
Very cool.
Prajnatara first appears in the koan as a little girl, a small child. So it was really important to me, for my understanding, to change Prajnatara to a little girl.
Interesting.
Because it was easier for me then to see myself.
Along similar lines to Reverend Scott's choice to switch the gender of Prajnatara, Reverend Teeter brings up the importance that Buddha nature has no gender.
But I don't want to get the other important thing you talked about was Buddha nature has no gender. And that's a really important component. So as you're working with male, female pronouns, and you're getting your way through how something is presented in the book, and you're trying to help a woman unpack that and untangle the language that hung her up in a book to the point that she wasn't even able to see the teaching anymore because of the language that was being used and presented to her.
Reverend Teeter then emphasized that religious scripture is never completely untouched by culture or time.
But then we have to remember that everything sort of gets hijacked along the way as you go through, you know, what was culture in Japan? What was the culture in China? What was the culture in Korea as Buddhism left India and moved its way to end up with us? Who was writing these? Who's translating these? And how do we look at that and be very, very aware that, okay, it landed in here, specifically United States, but then who brought it? How did it come here? And how do we work through that?
In our final question, we asked the priests about what changes are necessary in Zoto Zen to invite greater inclusivity in the tradition in America.
But what I've lived is every year that passes, women become more inclusive and are taking on more and more roles within Zoto Zen in this country. And so you see it in the Zoto Zen Buddhist Association. You see it in any Buddhist magazine you want to pick up. You see it in peer relationships and people that that work in all parts of the country, and even in Zoom land, now all people all around the world, where women have such a strong presence.
Although Reverend Teeter pointed out that there are more and more women represented, there are still many intersectionalities that need to be addressed, which Reverend Scott elaborated on.
Well, I think that the current emphasis on social justice and social action comes directly from female leadership. I think the next, frontier for Zoto Zen is more women of color in leadership as priests, more women of color who are priests, more women with disabilities. and maybe more young women with kids. You know, I think because the tradition is monastic, it's very hard for a woman to train. But I think we have to figure out a way to make that accessible, so that people don't have to put off ordaining while they're raising a family. Actually, we have a lay teacher in training who's just about to receive Dharma transmission. And I think if she had had her druthers, she would have become a priest 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I mean, she's a longtime practitioner, but she just couldn't figure out a way to do it.
Not only issues around ordination need to be addressed, but Reverend Scott also brought up needing to do more in uplifting the lay teachers.
So I would also say that I think Soto Zen needs to get its act together on lay teachers. And I think that there is a bit of arrogance, clerical arrogance, that we need to purge and really embrace lay teachers. For instance, right now, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association does not allow lay teachers to be members. It's priests only. I find that offensive, and I know other priests do, and I hope we change it.
The topic of inclusivity also begs the question of other social and environmental movements in the United States and how Soto Zen can evolve to benefit these efforts. Reverend Amaral began very broadly.
One thing is Zen itself is definitely a threat to society. Absolutely, there's no question about it. Because what we're doing in Zen is we are challenging our assumptions. And so many people, when they start sitting meaningfully, they realize, why am I in this job? And sometimes they might realize, why am I in this marriage? So I have often, you know, someone, I think Suzuki Roshi said, Zen ruins your life. This is what he was talking about. Your ideas of what you think your life is supposed to be. So it can get very messy for a while. And I have said that I don't think Zen solves any problems. It just helps me notice how many I have. And it gives me the energy to start getting busy, getting to work, you know, attending to these problems.
Reverend Scott weaved the deep contemplations that Reverend Amaral highlighted that come with Zen into addressing larger world issues.
I don't mean to get too sweeping or cosmic here, but I look at Western civilization now and what's happening to the earth. It has everything to do with being disembodied, you know, with a lack of connection to nature, to ourselves as animals, to that aspect of ourselves. And I feel very strongly if Buddhism is going to have any sort of impact culturally, and what's the point if it doesn't have an impact culturally, really? Then there has to be a reconnection to that aspect of our being.
Reverend Amaral spoke of the Zen Center North Shore receiving a recent donation from an anonymous contributor for a particular area of social justice.
She is really interested, as we are, in the racial justice work and the work around recovery. People working with addiction and connecting that with Zen practice and the process of awakening on the cushion. And so as a result, there's all this movement happening and this deep work. And at the center of this is this steering committee of these women of color. And there's something in there that we are incubating. And this is where I'll use the word incubate, where we're gestating. As the wonderful teacher Valerie Carr said, maybe this darkness we've been feeling for, you know, since 2016 is not the tomb, but the womb. we're about to give birth to something and it's going to be messy like every childbirth is. It's helpful because I think we sense that this work that we're doing around justice is scary. It's overwhelming. It takes a lot of courage, a lot of energy, but mostly it takes a willingness to be in vulnerability. And if you're going to do that work in a sustained and meaningful way and to connect it back to your own, my own happiness and peace, I better have good friends, like strong friendships, you know, of trust and truth telling.
To grow Soto Zen's responsiveness to social justice movements, Reverend Amaral suggests the importance of vulnerability and going beyond the rigidity of rules associated with Zen practice.
In the monastery, you're not supposed to drink alcohol. Well, it's fine. But one day after being there for several years, someone dropped a bottle of aged scotch on my desk. I was treasurer. I had this office and I couldn't believe it. And they were like, it's to keep you warm in the winter. And I'd never drank scotch before and it worked. As soon as the cold weather hit, I was like, And I'd been there for 3 years. And then I talked to the abbess and then she called in the reinforcements, these other two women. So there were these three women talking to me about it, like, Joan, this is serious. You're breaking, you know, a rule here. What are we going to do about this? And they decided to call Darlene to get her to talk to me. And Darlene's response to me was, Joan, in the realm of human delusion, alcohol is the least of your problems. And then when I at first I felt off the hook, and then I was like, wait a minute, what does she mean? And I asked her, and she said, it's about the places in intimacy where you feel threatened. And that is the heart of Zen practice. Zen practice is not about being a good little girl and don't drink alcohol and only wear black and keep your head shaved and walk around in shashu. That's easy. This is about being a complete human being. And so this is what I don't know if I try to model it. I kind of can't help it. But there is something about being off, you know, being authentic. And I don't feel like I'm ever there. I'm definitely not ever there. It's an, like, you never get there. Like enlightenment, you never get there. Like justice, we never get there. Democracy, we never get there. We're continually in a process of moving with the spirit of democracy, with the spirit of justice, with the spirit of awakening.
In the spirit of closing our podcast today, may we recollect the contemplations of these three wondrous ordained Soto Zen women priests who shared with us their deeply insightful stories on their embodiment as women, encounters with patriarchy, personal interpretations of religious scripture, and ideas about Soto Zen moving forward.
Our interviewees suggest that Zen must accept tampons and those that use them.
Not just the disembodied woman. Concludes our podcast for today. Special thanks to Reverend Yoshin Trisha Teeter, Reverend Toku Scott, and Reverend Nozin Joan Amaral. Many thanks to Dan Bennett and Travis Grandy. Also, much gratitude to the Andrew Mellon Foundation that supports public-facing student writing at Smith College.
Tune in next time on Women's Rights, in which we examine women's ordination in Reformed Judaism.